You know, I'd really like to start today's show doing something that my team, Olivia Rheingold and Tom Faust, Tyler Morris, our engineer, I'm not sure you've ever asked me to do this, but I don't give out our Twitter handle enough. PoliticsGPB, at PoliticsGPB. Tweet us and tell us what you're thinking. We love to have the opportunity to sometimes read your tweets on the air. And if you don't want to be on the air with your Twitter, then at least follow us. There's some really interesting conversations that happen on that account off and on in the course of a week or a month. Welcome to Political Rewind. If you're listening in real time, it is Friday, and we're all getting set for a weekend. We're joined today by Dr. Andra Gillespie. She's a political science professor at Emory University and a frequent panelist, thank goodness. We love having you on. Hi, Andra.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. You got big weekend plans?
Book revision.
Oh.
How, yeah.
So I don't want to hit on a sore subject, but mm-hmm. You're finishing up a very important book on
assessing President Obama's performance with respect to African American issues.
Yeah. And what was your deadline for getting this book turned in?
A long, long time ago. It's almost done.
Good. I'm looking forward to it because it'll obviously be something we're going to want to talk about on the show.
Yeah.
Mark Roundtree, President of Landmark Communications, one of the top political consulting and polling firms in the Southeast. Mark, you've been working hard. You've got a couple of races in this cycle, but more important, you're polling the mayor's race for Channel 2 Action News.
Yes, that's right. We've done it a number of times throughout the year, and that probably will happen again soon.
You got one more poll at least before?
That'll always be up to Channel 2.
Gotcha.
I would like to hope so.
Gotcha. All right. Well, at some point during the show, we are going to talk about the Atlanta mayor's race because we're getting down to the wire on this thing. It's a week from Tuesday, along with a number of other elections that we'll be following, both here in Georgia and in other parts of the country. So we'll talk about that a little later in the show. I do want to tell you, Jim Galloway is under the weather and couldn't join us today. So we hope he gets well that very quickly. He promises he will be back on Monday, and I really hope he can, because we have a great guest who's going to be live on the show on Monday, Charlie Sykes, who for decades was one of the most popular conservative radio talk show hosts in the country out of Milwaukee, is going to be here. Charlie got disenchanted with the Republican, with Trump during the campaign, and started talking out against Donald Trump, and he's continued that as Trump became president. He retired from his radio show to write a book, and he'll be here on Monday to talk about it. It should be a lot of fun. You know Charlie? Have you ever dealt with Charlie, Mark?
I never have.
Okay, well, he'll be here on Monday. How the Right Lost Its Mind. So we're hoping Jim will be back for that. Let me start with some breaking news that's, significant, I think. The New York Times has just moved a story, and let me read you a summary of it. The Russian attorney who met with Donald Trump Jr. and two other top Trump campaign officials during the 2016 presidential race first shared the information she planned to provide the campaign with the Russian government. The New York Times reported that Natalia Veselitskaya arrived at Trump Tower with a memo detailing information she believed was damaging to Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton's campaign, a memo which Veselitskaya shared months before with Russia's prosecutor general. And of course, under that meeting has been the subject of obviously a lot of media reporting, but it is also something that special counsel Robert Mueller has been looking into. This is significant, yes?
Well, I mean, it comes in a week of a lot of really important news stories about who was doing what during the campaign. So this comes out about, you know, more information about that June 2016 meeting with Donald Trump Jr. and Natalia Veselnitskaya, but it also comes on the Democratic, the DNC having to finally acknowledge that it did actually, you know, do opposition research where they, and they used information that eventually became part of this dossier that was leaked in January. And so nobody's come out of this looking good. And the thing that I think is getting lost in this, in part because people have chosen to lie about stuff, they maybe choosing to lie about stuff that perhaps might be shady and you know, on the bounds of legality, if not over the line. But then there are other things with respect to opposition research that are normal behavior. So the idea that somebody was putting together an opposition's file, and I'll have to disclaim here that the law firm that's involved in it, I'm involved with them in other cases.
You mean the law firm that paid for, or that was the go-between between the DNC and Clinton and
right.
Steele, the British, former British undercover agent.
Correct. So, I should disclaim that I'm doing work with that group on voting rights stuff. Just to kind of have that out, especially if this comes up in another story, but I don't have anything to do with this case. And so I want to make that very, very clear. Doing opposition research is not illegal. Doing opposition research, I would argue, if it's done correctly, is not unethical. It's normal behavior. And so for the Democrats to sit and lie about this and act like they had nothing to do with this actually makes what was probably okay activity look bad. And so you just gave ammunition to your opponents to try to then deflect attention away from other things that they might have been doing that may be fine if investigated, but also could, in fact, be really questionable.
Yeah. So we have two. You're giving us two threads we can follow for just a couple minutes, as long as we've started down that road. And one of them, of course, is, and we talked about it on the show on Wednesday, that it's... The Democrats have been caught in a big lie,
right,
saying that they had nothing to do with this dossier, which revealed information that allegedly exposed some salacious behavior by Trump in Moscow, as well as information about the campaign's ties to the Russian government. And as we said on Wednesday, you cannot wage a campaign against the president of the United States, call him a liar over and over and over again, and then get caught in a big lie yourself.
Right.
It really, even if the opposition, Mark, you have been involved in opposition research, I am sure, in
of
your
course.
Career.
Of course.
And suggesting that, I mean, opposition research, one of the things that's powerful about it is often it's true and accurate, right?
Correctly done, it's true, yeah.
Yeah. So the fact that we don't know whether this research is accurate or not. Robert Mueller will get to the bottom of it. Nevertheless, it makes the Democrats look bad at a time when they're hoping to keep the attention on Donald Trump.
And while that's true, how much shelf life does this issue have? There's a whole lot of evidence that the American public is actually pretty much over this issue in the first place. This is sort of maybe, is it more like a one-hit wonder of interest? Or is it actually something that has a lot of legs?
Have you polled the question? Have you asked people? I know you can only do so much in your polling. Have you ever polled how people feel about the Russia-Trump investigation?
No,
okay.
No, we haven't.
Okay. All right. And that brings us to the second thread, which is there's been so much back and forth on the Veselnitskaya meeting. Donald Trump Jr. first being caught saying, oh boy, if you've got information, we want it. Then we are told that, in fact, the meeting was really not about Hillary Clinton, and now it's back. This story that Veselnitskaya may have been reporting back to a high government official in the Russian government is going to fan the flames of this story.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure that Mueller and his team are investigating this and will eventually get to the bottom of it. But this would be the reason that opponents of the president would argue that you need to investigate this meeting. Because if you can establish a direct link between Veselnitskaya and the Kremlin, then that goes to evidence of collusion, that they were meeting with somebody who, you know, was you know, in conversation with people who are close to Vladimir Putin. So, you know, what this suggests is that for those who seek to oppose the president and oppose his activity, this is the kind of information that would be used to justify investigating this meeting.
Okay. We'll follow that story, of course, but wanted to get it out there because it has just been moved by the New York Times. Let's turn to another story that has as many questions, I think, as answers. We learned the other day, we know that some time ago, lawsuits were filed by a number of organizations which were convinced that the results of the 6th District Special Congressional Election were tainted. And they filed lawsuits asking for election data. This is all part of this question of whether the voting machines that we use in the state of Georgia are reliable and accurate. And that suit is ongoing. But we learned that the suit was filed on one day in early July. And a few days later, Mark, that election computer, which is at Kennesaw State University, that all that data was stored on, was erased.
Wiped. That's right.
Wiped clean. It doesn't look good, Mark.
It doesn't at all look good. It doesn't look good. I don't think you need me to tell you that, though. I think everybody sort of knows that. I think there's obviously, in my opinion, something here. And you can't say it's unprecedented, but it would be unprecedented at that level of intellect. The people that are running that software and that system, they know exactly what they're doing there. I'd find that hard to believe it was an accident.
Well, so in fact, it isn't an accident. The explanation that we got from the people who oversee that computer is FBI had already launched an investigation of these based on the lawsuits. And so that computer was wiped clean to make way for more data to be stored there on the assumption that FBI had already gotten what they needed. That's the explanation we get from the people who were overseeing that computer, Andra.
So, again, I do, disclaimer, I do other voting rights work, but if you could see my face, I'm rolling my eyes at that explanation because you wouldn't rely on the federal government repository in this instance to collect data. That's a nice backup, which, you know, it might prove very useful in this case, but this center is going to want to have ready access to its information and not have to go through bureaucratic hurdles to get it from the FBI, which was a backup in the first place. So just for me, that doesn't pass the smell test at all, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. And I think, you know, for many people, this speaks to the question of electronic voting machines. So, you know, forget the Russians. There was always that fear that when you didn't have a backup, a paper, you know, ballot, that people could say things that happened and then there wouldn't be any way to go back and verify it. And so I think for people who want a change to our voting machines so that there is a way to verify the types of votes that people make, this is evidence about why one needs to do that.
Mark, do you want to?
I was going to say, it's an issue that's been, we're pointing to the handle loss of race, but really that's only a little piece of it. And I don't think anybody really thinks that Ossoff won the election. I don't think anybody's trying to overturn an election here, which you couldn't do anyway, but I don't think most people think that. But I think a lot of the people that are involved in the advocacy of getting the voting machines changed over, they have been doing this for a number of years at this point. They're advocating for quite a while. And they're pointing out that, you know, think about your iPhone. It's 10 years old. These machines are twice that almost. So, you know, the technology they use, it may or may not be adequate. But I think the real question comes down to, will there be a loss of confidence in the public? Whether the machines work or not at some point, is the public going to finally say, that's enough, we hear too much noise, we see too much smoke?
And, you know, and if there's another thing that I would say about this whole excuse about we were just making room for more data, I'm not a technology person by any stretch of the imagination, but my sense is,
how many gigabytes in a terabyte? Quick.
Yeah, like that kind of stuff, don't ask me. I know the terabyte is bigger than the gigabyte.
At Landmark, we maintain the entire state of Georgia with a billion pieces of information about 6.5 million voters, and these are, you know, $5,000 machines. This isn't something that you have to wipe a machine to make.
Which
more
is
room
what
for.
I think where Andra was going.
You go buy another machine. You go expand your memory capacity. You know, I think about this, you know, as I switch over laptops. It's like I go buy more external hard drives so I can keep the old stuff. I don't go erase.
You at least back it up.
And back it, right. I don't go getting rid of stuff. Like, that just makes no sense. And especially for me, sometimes somebody who goes back and does, like, information with historical voting data, yeah, no, you don't erase that stuff because that information might be useful to somebody 10 or 20 years down the road.
So there's another point, though, because we are in the middle of a governor's race where the Secretary of State is running.
That's exactly right.
And, you know, the Secretary of State Kemp came out and very strongly used the term, this is undeniable ineptitude. But what's interesting there is it's not it's almost defaulting to ineptitude, if you think about the word, which is not even as bad as negligence. And the negligence, of course, is not as bad as deliberate, and who knows. But that word, those words are kind of, are they strong enough? He's in a precarious situation because he has to simultaneously argue while running for governor that he has done a good job as Secretary of State. And I'm not saying he did or didn't. This is just his political position. And yet these things are happening.
Go ahead.
And it's a difficult tightrope to walk.
I think you've hit on what the, in the long.
So and it may not be fair. It may not be fair to him because
exactly
he had right. nothing, by all accounts, nothing to do with any of this. But, you know, will voters just in the whole scheme of hearing all this noise about voting machines and the rest, are they finally going to hold someone responsible?
So that's another reason. So this story is important for two reasons. One, because you're right. We do have have to demand that our votes are counted accurately, reported accurately. Kathy Cox was on this show several weeks ago. And, of course, it was under her tenure as Secretary of State that we went to electronic voting machines in the first place. And Kathy said that she thinks it's time to rethink those machines and to have a machine that can not replace the electronic machine. She was very clear on that, but perhaps also provide a paper record.
Bill, let me ask a question here. I would ask this actually for people to tweet in, call in, however you want to communicate with them. But here's a question. Why does the state of Georgia, why does the Secretary of State's office have to maintain Social Security numbers on an ongoing basis for all voters? Why do we allow this situation? I get that you have to, you know, they have to verify their American citizens and the rest when you register to vote. But why do you have to maintain that? It just seems that it would be a giant security risk. And I actually asked that genuinely, and I've never had someone tell me an answer that was satisfactory to me. Why do we maintain the Social Security records? There's no requirement that we do this, to my knowledge.
Well,
can anyone answer that? And anyone in the audience, by the way?
You know, I mean, I think that is an interesting question. I remember as I was reading to prep for this, I thought about sort of the congressional bill that actually sort of required more stringent identification records, which has led to all kinds of things, this and voting rights. And in particular, knowing about sort of like what I put on my own voter registration card is the thing that I think might be least likely to be stolen in identity theft. And that does raise an interesting question I hadn't thought about before.
South Carolina has had an entire release, a hacking of their data.
Yeah.
And Georgia has, the office eventually released voting records for everybody in the state for free that had Social Security numbers on it. They've got all those disks back, they say, and there's not been any evidence of hacking. But why does government have to maintain it for this purpose? It just seems like it's something that hackers can steal.
And that brings it back to the other side of this, which you've already talked about, and that's the how this plays into the gubernatorial campaign. That's a question that I would think Brian Kemp, you're already laying out a line of questioning for him as he runs for governor. And I think what's fascinating about this is that this is going to add fuel to the fire that's already burning hot between candidate Brian Kemp and Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams, who has been at war with Kemp even in her role as a minority leader in the House when she launched the New Voter Project to try to register new voters, claimed back then in the most adamant terms that the Secretary of State's office wasn't processing these the way they should have. And we already know that that's going to be a fight that will happen between Kemp and Abrams throughout this campaign. I'm interested in the fact, Andra, that with the exception of Michael Williams, no other Republican candidate for governor running against Kemp has yet jumped on this and tried to make hay out of it.
But so the question that I'm thinking about is thinking about the three-way race. So I'm thinking about Williams, Cagle, and Kemp, is how do voters position themselves? So say people are turned off by Kemp because they think he's mismanaged the office, as evidenced by like these types of controversies.
And Hunter Hill, by the way, the fourth guy, who's actually in second place in the gubernatorial race on the Republican
side. So where would Kemp voters defect? In particular, I think that that's the big question in terms of thinking about, you know, does this help Michael Williams in particular as kind of the insurgent candidate, or does, you know, or would it go to a more mainstream candidate like Casey Cable or Hunter Hill?
I don't mean to interrupt, but I got to get a break in. Monday's Child tweets, we expect in all caps a change in the voting machines. We're only one of a few states that still have this old technology, which leave no paper trail. Dan Browning tweets, ineptitude or not, shouldn't the supervision of election machines be something where the buck stops with the Secretary of State? And that will be an issue in the campaign. So thanks for those tweets. Politics GPB, our handle. Join the conversation. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back with a lot more in just a minute.
If you supported GPB during our fall fund drive, thank you. We're already putting your dollars to work to deliver the service you've come to expect and enjoy from GPB. If you didn't get a chance to donate during the drive, your online contribution now will still make a difference. Please take a couple of minutes now to go to our website, gpb.org, and click the green donate button at the top of the page. Thanks so much for your support of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Dr. Andra Gillespie and Republican pollster Mark Roundtree. Well, he's a Republican consultant when he does... You do internal polling for campaigns as well as the polling that you do for organizations like WSB-TV, I assume.
Polling is just a small piece of our business, actually. We work for candidates all over the state of Georgia.
Okay.
It's just a signature thing that we do for Georgia, is the polling.
It's a selfless act for all of us in the media who need things to talk about like polls. All right. Let's move on. There was a story today. You know, we're now, of course, in an enrollment period for health insurance, and ACA rates are out. And it turns out that Georgia's premiums in the Affordable Care Health Insurance Exchange are among, Andra, the top 10 in the United States. The firm called Avalere, I guess is how you say it, has just studied average 2018 premium rates for all 50 states. Georgia's in the top 10. And here's an example of what's happening here. A 50-year-old individual who has too much, who's making too much money for subsidies, about 50 plus thousand a year, if you accept the silver plan, which is kind of the middle plan, they would pay this year $807 a month, up from $544 currently. That's painful.
Yeah, that's really, really painful. I mean, so the questions that I would ask about the states and how they rank is, you know, who took Medicaid expansion and who didn't. And then, you know, and I think, you know, it shows that there were issues that needed to be addressed in the Affordable Care Act, but it also shows that their behavior on the part of insurance companies. And so when you have fewer options and less competition because of business and or political reasons, that this is also going to affect people. And I think hopefully what people think about as they try to figure out how to reshape healthcare is to remember people and premiums in the process. And so we need to think about the price, but we also need to think about the quality and type of care that people actually have access to for what they
you know,
pay for.
Mark, the insurance companies are saying that, I mean, clearly we were going to have increases anyway. And some of that is because the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, needs fixing in any case. But the insurance companies are also saying that Washington is so confused about what it wants to do about health care, that uncertainty is pushing up prices as well. We've got this bipartisan plan sitting there in Congress that is now nobody's paying any attention to at this moment because, well, I shouldn't say nobody. It's not getting a lot of attention because now everybody's focused on the tax plan. What's your polling shown about people's attitude about Obamacare as opposed to repealing and replacing over the years?
We have not polled it this year while Trump has been president. We have polled it many times previous to Trump being president because a lot of candidates would run on this topic. And what we find is that more people historically have opposed ACA. There could be some slight partisan shift because when a president first takes over, as Trump has done, they last about 100 days and then their polling numbers start tanking. It just happens almost with every administration. And their policies become less popular. Well, so the overturn of ACA has sort of, the support of that has gone down since Trump has been president. But in the past, for example, here in Georgia, this surprises some people. We were just talking about this before the show. It surprises conservatives because conservatives very uniquely dislike ACA and a lot of self-employed people. But the real numbers show is that Georgians are relatively split on it. We have a very large minority population. The minority population has given President Obama, when he was president, a major pass on a lot of policies. And so this group pretty much has stayed very supportive of ACA and Obamacare, and, you know, another 10% maybe net on top of that. So I'd say the bottom line in Georgia, it's probably a 49-50 support for repeal and about a 42-43 support for keeping it.
Any chance we're going to see, we're not going to see anything on this, are we, Andra?
What do you mean?
I mean, on actually this bipartisan plan, anything really happening at this point?
So I have always thought that the things that you're going to see are changes on the margins that Republicans were advocating for 8 years ago that they just are waiting to implement. So the things that I think you're going to see are there ways that we could change the insurance business to make it more profitable for people? So insurance portability, so that people can sell across state lines, like those kinds of things. We can see whether or not they tort reform to see whether or not that actually has the ability to be able
tort
to drive
reform. Boy, I didn't know you were that conservative, Dr. Gillespie.
I'm the child of an insurance executive. So, who specialized in malpractice. And so
it's also causing a lot of interest. I'm on social media. I assume you guys are. I see a lot of people talk about when you get ACA news coming up, they start talking about MediShare and Liberty Share, I think it's called, these alternative to insurance companies. And my family has done that. It cut our rates by 2/3 of cost.
Okay.
So if people were smart, they would try to look at these types of options because there's this fundamental structural problem about our healthcare costs just being astronomical because of some scaling issues that we have to deal with. And so this would be an opportune time for Republicans to try those things to see if they work better than, you know, the ACA model, which was moving towards single payer, so that we have some comparison to see which is better and which wasn't.
Do you think that there is a limited... Here's a hypothesis I would have. I think it's something like 7% of Americans are full-time self-employed, and self-employed people have been uniquely devastated. I'm self-employed, and this really has hurt us, but have been really hurt by it. Well, a lot of the self-employed folks, statistically, are more on the Republican side. Do you think that because the people that feel the most intensely, it's not as simple, I am not saying, by the way, just to be clear, that Republicans, self-employed people are Republicans. That's not what I'm saying. But I'd say preponderantly that's probably true. Do you think that that has had a result on why Republicans have made this an issue by and large and Democrats haven't, that it doesn't affect as many self-employed people that call themselves Democrats?
I think that's a plausible hypothesis that's worth testing, but without any data, and I'm just trying to think of questions in my head where I think people have asked that question. I don't know of, you know, any survey or any model that tests that, so I would look into it.
Or is it rural areas that are more upset about it?
Well,
the loss of hospitals. Georgia is losing hospitals.
Where we're having real problems in the rural communities hospitals are rapidly drying up.
A direct connection to ACA is the loss of those hospitals.
Yes. Okay. So I want to move on, but I want to make sure. I think you said something really important. It's something I kind of emphasize over and over on the show. It is so easy for us to fall into the habit of talking about the games of politics, you know, repeal and replace. Oh, the Republicans can't get it done. Democrat, you know, these are real people's lives we're talking about. And that's how you started, Andra, and I'm really glad you did. I mean, it is just awful to think that there are people out there right now who cannot afford to buy health insurance for their families. And unfortunately, that's not the way they're looking at it in Washington. It appears to me, as an observer, to them it's all the zero-sum game of who wins and who loses, Republicans or Democrats. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Oh, thanks.
Let's move on to another big story this week, and listen to this.
This epidemic is a national health emergency. It is time to liberate our communities from this scourge of drug addiction. Never been this way. We can be the generation that ends the opioid epidemic. We can do it.
President Trump yesterday, interesting, Andra, people paid attention to the fact he called it a public health emergency as opposed to calling it a national emergency. The rhetoric is significant because a public health emergency does not automatically trigger new federal funds to put into an effort. Now, we don't know. Perhaps the president will, in fact, come follow up and suggest new funding. But here he was making his big announcement. And the question is, aside from calling attention to it, which goodness knows is meaningful, we don't know what it means practically and pragmatically.
So we're at the intersection of symbolic and substantive politics. And so I think that that's what people are getting at when they're looking at the distinctions and what this means. So this was a really important symbolic gesture. And symbolic gestures are important because they do actually help set the agenda and can put other political actors, set other political actions in motion. So I don't want to discount the importance of symbolic politics. However, the other sort of side of this is that he had at his disposal the option to commit money. And not committing money is sort of evidence of sort of the substantive attitude toward that. Like people talked about these things in light of, you know, budgetary proposals, you know, came out earlier, and we'll talk a little bit more about what the actual budget looks like later. So you can make all of these nice platitudes, but then if it's not followed up, if you don't put your money where your mouth is, so to speak, then it becomes a question about whether or not those gestures are in fact hollow. And you know, one of the members of the commission, former Congressman Patrick Kennedy, himself, you know, a recovering substance abuser, you know, noted that, like, they don't want to be part, he doesn't want to be part of a photo opportunity.
Yeah.
That his goal of being in this is to actually provide some real concrete advice that can be implemented and hopefully aid people who are struggling.
I was struck. I mean, number one, yes, there are serious questions about what the president's going to do. I was struck when you talk about symbolic gestures and the value of them. I was struck by the fact that the president, for the first time in I'm aware of, opened up in a big public forum about his brother Fred, who was not a drug addict. He was an alcoholic, and it was alcohol that essentially killed him. And I thought that was one of the few times, Mark, that I've seen President Trump bring something of his personal life into an issue and talk about it in a fairly meaningful way.
Yes, usually he brings other people's lives into the issue. So it was exposing himself on something kind of vulnerable and something that is difficult is unusual.
All right, I mean, go ahead, finish what you were saying.
Well, I guess I should pay close attention to what you said a little while ago of not just looking at, which I don't, the political aspect of things, but it's why you invited me.
Of course.
But the political side of this is that Trump has found himself in a lot of very partisan battles so far, as he would. It's his first year. But we may be seeing a pivot toward less partisan issues. This is not an issue that is going to be something that is a Republican-Democrat issue. And so I tend to wonder if this is sort of where they're going to start evolving.
That would be an interesting development if that's what happens here.
I can't say I'm holding my breath for that.
Yeah, I'm not either, but I think it's an interesting thought. Maybe he needs you to come up there and start consulting for him. Here's the other side of this, though. I think we give the president credit for using the bully pulpit to call attention, talking about his family's life. But then here's one of the comments he made that I think leaves us a little puzzled. Let's listen.
This was an idea that I had where if we can teach young people not to take drugs, just not to take them, when I see friends of mine that are having difficulty with not having that drink at dinner, where it's literally almost impossible for them to stop, I say to myself, I can't even understand it. Why would that be difficult? But we understand why it is difficult. The fact is, if we can teach young people and people generally not to start, it's really, really easy not to take them. And I think that's going to end up being our most important thing. Really tough, really big, really great advertising. So we get to people before they start.
President Trump yesterday, Andra, our producer Tom Faust pointed out this morning, this is Nancy Reagan.
Thank you. That was exactly what I was about to say.
Go ahead. Say it.
And I grew up in the 80s and had to
just
be there.
Say
just
no.
Say no. I'm not opposed to simplistic recommendations for people. And sort of thinking about it in this way. I mean, one of the things that was actually really interesting about President Trump's brother was there, you know, were other reasons in the family. Like, so the brother was the black sheep of the family, the one who didn't want to go into real estate, the one who tried and just did not live up to his father's expectation. And so perhaps part of the reason why he turned to alcohol abuse was the fact that he, you know, didn't feel sort of like that he, had been the success that everybody would have said. And President Trump, as the younger brother and the favored child, the favored son in this enterprise, admitted that he wasn't actually the nicest to his brother, really didn't understand everything until, you know, much, much later in his life, and that he had some regrets about how he had treated his brother and the type of advice that he gave him. And so some of that is still working out here. Personal responsibility, I don't want to discount that. I think that people are responsible for their actions and responsible for how they respond to certain types of situations, but you've got to understand that there are also important structural things to keep into account.
It was well-meaning, no question. I wouldn't even doubt the well-meaningness of what he said. But Mark, it unfortunately reinforces what many people feel, which is that President Trump doesn't understand the depths that are required to get issues. He doesn't have it. And I find it, unless I missed it, there wasn't anyone who joined him at the podium with expertise in drug addiction he could point to and say, we've learned from this woman, this man, how serious an addiction, and can talk about it with some scientific understanding, which is why it ends up being like, just say no. Nancy Reagan came to Atlanta during the middle of that Just Say No campaign. She did a tour. And I remember covering her. She was out at, I think, Cumberland Mall in Cobb County. And it was the same kind of simplistic message, which had no teeth because of that, right? You
know? And she would always get a lot of criticism for that. Yeah. A lot of schools went with the program and then pulled back from it when it didn't maybe have the effect that they wanted it to have.
Yeah.
Right. Because there is an unemployment aspect to this. There is sort of the structure about how doctors prescribe medicine and whether or not you need to give opioids for everything or do you need to give them in the quantities that you give them out. Like, there are all these structural issues, and President Trump usually tends to kind of fall short on recognizing structural problems.
The physicians in the legislature do understand that there's a problem with this. This is a regular conversation that I have with pharmacists and physicians who are in the legislature and folks in the healthcare industry. I think Georgia may have a uniquely bad problem.
We have a terrible problem
here. North Georgia area in particular.
Yeah, I think that's right. In fact, I would recommend all of you, if you have a subscription to the AJC, Google Michael Cannell, K-A-N-E-L-L. He's a business reporter for the AJC, and he wrote a major takeout not long ago, within the last week or so, on just the devastating financial impact this crisis is having, particularly, as you say, in suburban and exurban Georgia. We got to get another break in. So let's do that. When we come back, we've still got so much to talk about. I don't even want to try to start listing it. So you're listening to Political Rewind.
New accusations of sexual harassment or assault by powerful men seem to be coming out daily. Why now? One theory goes back to the Women's March in January.
That was sort of the first inkling that we had that this really was something. Women were upset, and like the old movie, they weren't going to take it anymore.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered 4 to 7 this afternoon here on GPB. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, a major contributor to the economic and cultural vitality of downtown Atlanta and the metro Atlanta area.
This is Political Rewind. Dr. Andre Gillespie and Mark Rountree are with me. We're going to do a little change of pace right now. CNN this week, which has been under attack, as everybody knows, by President Trump almost since since before he took office, actually. They released a marketing spot. We're going to play the audio. Many of you have already seen it, but if you haven't, all I have to say is all you see while you're listening to the audio that we're about to play is a big, beautiful red apple sitting on a stand on a shelf with a kind of a neutral background behind it. And it, nothing else happens visually. And as we sit and look at the apple, we hear this.
This is an apple. Some people might try to tell you that it's a banana. They might scream banana, banana, banana over and over and over again. They might put banana in all caps. You might even start to believe that this is a banana. But it's not. This is an apple.
Yeah, the last thing we see on the screen are the words facts matter, I think, is correct. So CNN fighting back in a somewhat humorous and yet pointed way.
I mean, they're not the first to do this. The New York Times has done a variation on saying that they're going to be purveyors of truth in tough times. I mean, I think the Washington Post tagline about how democracy dies in darkness, yeah, I think is also sort of fitting into this theme. And then, you know, and I think it is really sort of speaking to the culture that we have now where facts are contested. You know, interpretations can be contested. The appropriateness of certain types of evidence to marshal in favor of answering specific questions, you can always debate those kinds of things. But, you know, when people are literally arguing about things that are right in front of their face, or when you point out that somebody has just lied to you and they tell you no, they didn't, even though they were on tape and we can play it back, you know, I think that, you know, this speaks to our time and speaks to sort of who we are as a culture and what our values are. And then given the fact that CNN is a target and has been called fake news so many times, you know, they're taking on the attack head on and trying to assert what their values are.
You know, there's something to be said for the old-fashioned newspaper, because when they mess up, they can do a correction the next day. Because of the style of TV where you can watch it 24 hours a day, if you see a correction, you'd be lucky. And, you know, I think that you're saying that facts are facts and therefore kind of should be indisputable. But I think there are a lot of people who are questioning, what are those facts on a 24-hour news cycle? Whether one likes Trump or not, whether one likes particular issues or not, there have been a lot of cases where facts actually were disputable because they weren't facts. They were created facts.
Right. And I think that is a little bit unfair, because even in a 24-hour news cycle, there are still television reporters who do, you know, provide corrective reports if there's something that came out and then they learn more and realize that the information is wrong. And certainly on their web platforms where things are written out, there are corrections that kind of, you know, that they'll put at the ends of articles if something is wrong or if something changes. And so not everybody, not all political actors are doing that kind of stuff. In fact, there are people who double down on it. So, you know, I still think that they're following the ethical standard of correcting stuff when they're wrong.
As long as we're playing TV commercials, I want to play one that appeared this morning on Fox and Friends, of all places. And it was an ad, and I can't find it. It was an ad paid for by a billionaire, and I'm just blocking the name right now, and I don't have it in front of me, and I'll find it in a minute. What, an anti-Trump billionaire. Yeah. Say it again, Olivia. Shayer. Okay. A billionaire has put a lot of money into, and I'll look it up too, anti-Trump campaigns. But this morning, he really went out of his way to tweak the president. On Fox and Friends, there was this commercial.
He's brought us to the brink of nuclear war, obstructed justice at the FBI, and in direct violation of the Constitution, he's taken money from foreign governments and threatened to shut down news organizations that report the truth. If that isn't a case for impeaching and removing a dangerous president, then what has our government become? I'm Tom Steyer, and like you, I'm a citizen who knows it's up to us to do something. It's why I'm funding this effort to raise our voices together and demand that elected officials take a stand on impeachment. A Republican Congress once impeached a president for far less. Yet today, people in Congress and his own administration know that this president is a clear and present danger, who's mentally unstable and armed with nuclear weapons. And they do nothing. Join us and tell your member of Congress that they have a moral responsibility to stop doing what's political and start doing what's right. Our country depends on it.
So I apologize that I wasn't ready to tell you exactly what's behind this commercial. His name is he's Tom Steyer, S-T-E-Y-E-R. He's a billionaire who has pumped as much as $91 million into Democratic candidates in the 2016 cycle. And that is him on camera telling us this. And Mark, first of all, we have sort of outlawed the word impeachment on this show because we know that's not happening. Nevertheless, when a guy goes on Fox and Friends and throws it right in the face of the president, who said many times it's his favorite TV show, that's worth talking about at least briefly.
It's worth talking about briefly that this is a Democrat billionaire. Yeah. So I think that closes the conversation. It just because he's a billionaire doesn't mean he's some capitalist or a Republican.
Oh, no, I get that. I'm just saying he's gone right to Trump's favorite TV show to get this message.
No, I mean, and so I think he did that to be intentionally provocative. But
I think so.
I think the issue is, how do we interrogate the claims that he's making? You know, I think some of the claims, you know, are opinionated, and it's not surprising that a Democrat would have those opinions. And also, I think some of the things that he's saying are allegations where the investigation process is still going on.
Right.
And then it could very well be that once the investigation is complete and you've marshaled a lot of evidence, then you can say unequivocally whether or not, or with greater certainty, not completely unequivocally, but with greater certainty, whether or not these allegations are true. And I think that's the thing that's most important, is that there are a lot of Democrats, you know, think about Representative Al Green in particular, you know, who clearly have an end run in mind, but you got to build the case. And frankly, it hasn't been enough time to build the case.
Right. Well, that's why we don't talk about impeachment on this show. It's just, it's not going to happen anytime soon, if ever. And perhaps it shouldn't. So, but that was worth pointing out. Lest we wonder whether Trump is watching Fox and Friends. He saw the spot and almost immediately tweeted, "Wacky and totally unhinged. Tom Steyer, who has been fighting me and my Make America Great Again agenda from beginning, never wins elections!" Exclamation point. Just an interesting little story to point out today. Let's talk about the Atlanta mayor's race for just a couple minutes. Okay, Mark, you're very, you know it well because you've been polling on the race. And it strikes me that, first of all, there's been this really, I think, strange story that doesn't quite relate to the mayor's race, except in a way it does. We learned that a sum of money, some $580,000, that was part of a pot of money that was raised when voters in Atlanta agreed to put money into a T-SPOT transportation initiative, went unspent. And at least some, if not a lot, of this money is now being funneled into the campaigns of pro-Kasim Reed, the mayor's city council candidates, incumbents, which we don't know that it's legal, or we don't know that it's illegal, but it's close, yes?
And I think there will be a lot of folks who question the legality of it. That, you know, Robert Highsmith has argued
Mayor's
on behalf
attorney.
Yes, has argued that this is legal because it is a nonprofit. May or may not be right. He is a good attorney, though. The Lane at the Ethics Commission has said generally no. So you have quite a different view there. And consultants have also received $25,000 here, $30,000
there.
Well,
you don't argue with that, do you?
Well, I didn't get any of it, so absolutely. No, of course, I think this is probably something that the legislature may want to look at if it is legal. I don't think this was not the intent of the funds when they were.
Yeah, the law says you have to give this to a nonprofit. You cannot use it for purposes that it wasn't intended, except if you do give it to, say, a nonprofit organization, meaning a charity typically, right?
Right. And so what Highsmith's argument is that campaigns are technically nonprofits. And
yes.
So these just basically discovered a loophole. And so, you know, unfortunately, this is how democracy works. People make laws, people figure out in runs out of them. You have to decide whether or not that breaks the spirit of the law, if not the letter of the law. And if you're outraged enough about it, then you go and change it so that you can close
sure.
the loophole.
Sure. And by the time this is all litigated, the candidates who got the money in city council races may be back in for another term, and who thinks about it anymore.
Right, but now that the information is out there, this is, you know, an additional bit of information that voters can use to make decisions, you know, about whether or not they, you know, stand by or support or endorse this type of behavior. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, most people think that nonprofits were that he was going to give to Habitat for Humanity or something else along those lines.
The reason I said that it in a way plays into the mayor's race is because one of the big questions that's been raised is whether any of this money would end up in the campaign of the candidate who Mayor Reed has endorsed, Keisha Lance Bottoms. We're all being told, no, she is not going to benefit from this money. Which brings me to, Mark, we only got a couple minutes yet left, but we're a week and a half from the mayor's election here. And this thing seems to be evolving into, tell me if I'm wrong, the potential for two white candidates to be fighting for a slot in the runoff and several African-American candidates fighting for a slot in the runoff. You've got Mary Norwood, who appears to be out front, but Peter Amon, another white candidate in the race, pushing hard to try to get up there as well. You've got Keisha Lance Bottom, and then behind her, you've got Caesar Mitchell, Kwanzaa Hall, all these other people. Is that the way it's breaking down?
The last time we polled it at Landmark Communications, we had a fairly close race for the top slots, and that would be between Mary Norwood and Keisha Lance Bottoms, just a couple of points apart at the time. And Bottoms has continued to actually have trajectory with a lot of movement. So we could potentially see her finishing very well at the end. I tend to think it'll be the two of them at the end.
Norwood and Bottoms.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, that's what the trend looks like.
She's being attacked like crazy, as you would expect for somebody who seems to have momentum.
Well, I mean, you know, people are going to have to figure out a way to try to distinguish themselves. But it's just a question of just looking at sort of the trend in the polls over time. And so, you know, Mary Norwood has had sort of her pretty consistent lead. And then it was a question of who was going to break out. Now, I think still, just because there's so many people in the race, you still have to say that, you know, that second place position might not be who we think it is. You just kind of have to, you know, just make that disclaimer. But yeah, I mean, smart money would say probably it's Mary Norwood and Keisha Lance Bottoms.
So one of the operatives, Rebecca Waldorf, actually, from the Fort campaign, we spoke this week, and she made a very convincing argument that they're heavy on the ground.
And that's crucial.
If the turnout goes south, and it is not going to be, if the turnout is low, you will see the turnout machines actually taking more. And the turnout machine, that term, I don't mean derogatorily. I'm saying the people that have actually knocked the doors and do the calls.
That's Kathy Willard's argument.
And that's Kathy Willard's
argument. Kathy Willard says, I've identified my voters. I can get them to the polls. I can make a runoff.
Front runners, a lot of the vote in a front runner status is oftentimes advertising, but if people don't vote. And right now, in terms of early voting in the city of Atlanta, there have been, as of yesterday, 8,400 voters, 61% African-American, 37% white. But compare this briefly. Fulton County has had 15,000 voting early, 49% white, 48%
for their
Fulton
races.
County chairman's race.
Wow.
Overall. So right. Fulton is majority white. Atlanta is 61-37 African-American.
Thank you. That's really good information for us. And it's also got to be the last word in today's show because we are rapidly approaching the moment when I have to turn our show over to All Things Considered. So Mark Rountree, Andra Gillespie, thanks for a really great conversation this afternoon. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Monday, Charlie Sykes, How the Right Lost Its Mind. You may not agree with that, so you ought to listen to what Charlie Sykes has to say when he joins us for the 2 o'clock Political Rewind. Olivia Rheingold, Tyler Morris, Tom Faust, thanks for your work today. See y'all again on Monday.